Hello, and welcome to the New Books Network podcast in environmental studies. My name is David Fowser. Today, I'm joined by Dr. Stephen Gray, who's a senior lecturer in imperial and naval history at the University of Portsmouth. His most recent book is Steam Power and Sea Power, Coal, the Royal Navy, and the British Empire, circa 1870 to 1914. Dr. Stephen Gray, welcome.
Thank you very much.
It's a pleasure to have you here, and I'm really looking forward to discussing this. And I wonder if you might start by telling us a little bit about your own personal background, where you've studied in the past, how you ultimately came to this particular project.
Yes, so I started, my undergraduate in South Wales, in Swansea, and did my master's there in imperial and maritime history. And then I did my PhD between the University of Warwick and the National Maritime Museum, which is in Greenwich in London, which was a fairly similar project, I suppose, to how the book turned out. So looking at the Navy in the Age of Steam, essentially, and how the shift from sail to being powered by coal really had ramifications beyond just changing engines, essentially. So I did my PhD, finished that in 2014. And since then, I had a year-long lectureship at Swansea, so back to where I did my undergraduate. And then I've moved to Portsmouth now, which is ideal, really, because it's where the Royal Navy is based. So everything's on my doorstep that I research. So it's quite a nice place to be. So I've been there now 2.5 years, so sort of settled in, I suppose, now.
Outstanding. And so this has been a long project. How did you start the project? How do you get interested in this particular topic, in the topic of coal and its role in the Royal Navy and the British Empire?
I mean, it's as I said, I did my master's in imperial and maritime history, so my background was in a similar field, I suppose. And it was actually a project that came up that my two supervisors had got money from a grant for, essentially. So it was a funded project that I applied for. And I suppose it joined the two things that I was interested in, really, in the sea and the British Empire, really. And I suppose as the more I got into it, the more I was able to shape the project into the sorts of things that I was particularly interested in. I think we'll go on to discuss why I think the book's important, obviously, but it allowed me to explore lots of different elements of the empire, but also oceanic networks and I suppose as well networks of raw materials as much as anything else, and by sort of starting with quite a quotidian cheap fuel, how you could go from that to explore much wider issues about the empire and the world in this period.
I guess this is the spot to go to the argument itself, which is really about the role of coal in the Age of Steam, which is a relatively short age. I was surprised to find that. But could you, what do you, how would you sort of outline the argument of the book as you see it, as you intend it to come across?
I mean, essentially, as you say, it's a fairly short period, really. The adoption of steam power really only becomes I suppose accepted across a large part of the fleet in the second half of the 19th century, and really by the start of the 20th century, we're starting to see the beginning of oil power. It was quite a short period, but it's a crucial period for British history, and it's a period that I suppose many imperial historians would see as the high point of European imperialism. Really, that the period where the biggest part of imperial competition is going on, and also you start to see the build up of British naval power, which obviously reaches its apogee in the 20th century in the Anglo-German naval race. So it's a period of immense change, and that sort of geopolitical change is also matched by an enormous growth in trade. There's a tenfold increase in trade during that sort of 50-60 year period. Most of it is British, most of it is maritime. So the Navy is enormously important to British power, ensuring British economic power. So all of that background is crucial to understanding why that shift from sail to steam is so problematic and so important to get your head around, I suppose, because what you're essentially doing is you're creating a problem for your Navy, essentially, because unlike when you're sail powered, you have to stop for fuel. And in this period, it's pretty much once a week, they're going to have to stop for fuel, which means if you're a worldwide power like Britain is in this period, you have to make sure that there is somewhere for your ships to go and get fuel at any given moment. So it creates a...
Can we pause for a moment and consider how, you know, so you can say once a week, and I thought that was astonishing to learn how frequently it is. How far could a ship go in a week?
That's a good question, and one that there's not a straight answer for. I mean, part of the issues that they face really is that the way that the Royal Navy works is they are the technology is constantly evolving in this period and very quickly as well. And what happens essentially is when they launch a new ship, it sort of creates a ripple effect of pushing older ships further away from Britain. So what essentially happens is the newest ships tend to be either in home waters or the Mediterranean, the two most important parts. They then go out to China and then to places like the Pacific or the South Atlantic. So what happens is those ships sort of move further and further out. So usually the Pacific and South Atlantic are they're the last place with sail ships. They're the last place with coal-powered ships. So it depends, really. Is a cop-out answer because at any given time there's a real range of different ships across the world, and you know, really, that has a huge effect on how efficient the engines are, how much coal they can carry, what sort of speeds they go, et cetera, et cetera. So it's very difficult to say those sorts of things. Another key consideration is that a lot of the time, because of the relative peace of this period, ships tend to sort of go around about 10 knots, so basically cruising speeds. If they then have to go up to full speed, and by the end of this period, we're talking over 20 knots, it's basically an exponential curve of how much fuel is used. So coal usage very much changes on speed as well. So because naval ships obviously don't keep to timetables in the same way as a trade ship might, their usage can go up and down. And that's part of the problem for Britain as well, is trying to work out how much coal needs to be in which place, because obviously if you face an emergency, you might suddenly have 10 ships in one place that wouldn't usually be there. So it's part of the difficulty of moving to coal is ensuring that supply is there whatever the situation, even in emergencies where you might suddenly have demand.
And so So creating a steam-powered Royal Navy then means not just building ships that are going to run on coal, but building an entire network of coal supplies, essentially creating like a kind of a material chain that connects coal mines, coal production areas, to the particular bases or stopping points that British ships will need.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes, and I suppose that's really the what the book tries to explore. Really, what those the ramifications of creating those networks does. I mean, Britain has immense advantages in this because, several advantages. It has the best coal for the Navy in South Wales. And when I say the best coal for the Navy, I suppose it sounds like an obvious point, but not all coal is the same. And the Navy is looking for very specific qualities for its ships.
Yeah, can you go into like what are the different qualities of coal and why was it that coal from South Wales was so much better?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, firstly, you want something which produces high power, but you want something that produces high power but doesn't burn too quickly, because obviously you have a finite supply that you can carry. So you want efficiency as well. You also don't want too many impurities in there, because that affects both efficiency but also creates black smoke. And if you're a naval ship, you don't particularly want to be seen from a long way away. And also, for example, in navigating harbors and things, if you have too much smoke, it's very difficult to be able to actually see what's going on. So there's several factors that make Welsh coal the best. And I mean, I suppose another quality is how easy it is to work with, sort of how much what's called clinker, which is essentially sort of ash and residue, it creates, because that has to obviously be cleaned out. So if it has to be cleaned out a lot, that then creates extra work for those dealing with it. So there's lots of different qualities, but essentially what happens is they do all these tests and realise that actually the coal from South Wales is above all others. And that's seen in the fact that it's used widely by other navies as well. It's worth saying that they do discover in New Zealand another supply in a place called Westport, which is similar quality, but the mine is... it's a new mine essentially, so it takes a little longer to come on stream, and it only really starts to about 10% of naval fuel comes from Westport. It's about 90% from Wales. But what's quite interesting about that fact, and going on to, I suppose, to those ramifications, is the fact that because of that, you're exporting Welsh coal as far away as places like Fiji, places like China, places as far away as Vancouver. Looking at 14,000 nautical miles and enormous distances, and also completely uneconomical distances. Coal is not worth enough money to do that. For profit. So essentially the Navy is taking a big financial hit to make sure that high quality fuel is there. So it really is a matter of, we might call it something like incremental returns or those little things which would give the Navy an advantage in a battle situation, the ability to go that little bit faster, the ability to go that little bit further, the ability not to be seen, for example. So it really is that crucial, the difference. And you find in all sorts of documents explicitly stated that this is why we use this coal. We would not use others. Absolutely. That's really important.
Can we spin off two issues there? One is I'm curious if we could consider this particular kind of coal relative to the broader coal-powered kind of world of 19th century Britain. Was this coal particularly expensive? Was it widely regarded as the highest quality, sort of full stop? Was there some competition between naval demand for this coal and other uses? And then the other way I'd like to spin this off is to consider really a major portion of the first part of the book, which is kind of the institutionalization of simply knowing and obtaining and managing this coal. And you can handle those two in any way that you'd like.
Yeah, I mean, it's worth saying, I mean, the point I made earlier about it being uneconomical means, of course, that for most maritime concerns, for example, things like postal concerns or any sort of maritime trade, essentially, usually they go for the cheapest coal, unless there is a particular reason why they need to be particularly fast. So sometimes, for example, if you're looking at things like cruise liners, P&O or whatever, they may use better quality coal because they want to go a bit faster. They don't want dirty soot everywhere. But largely the cost means that they are not using this coal. They don't tend to use it, for example, in railways, again, for similar reasons. If you wanted to make sure it was an express train or whatever, you may use it. But largely, most commercial concerns would use the cheapest one they could get away with, essentially, because most of the time they didn't have those same needs as a navy. And I, off the top of my head, haven't got the facts, but certainly the Admiralty is the biggest customer of the South Welsh coal field. It's the biggest single buyer of coal, so absolutely it's the particular concern that really is driving that industry, and the prices, because of its quality, are particularly high. There is competition, certainly in the earlier periods, I suppose from about the 1840s to the 1880s is the real period of trials, and they trial all sorts of coals from the northeast of England. It's particularly fierce rivalry, but also in places like Australia, places like North America, have their coals trialed. And nothing really comes close to Welsh. There is something, they do sort of agree that the coal from Pennsylvania is a similar kind, but it's much more difficult to get to the sea, essentially. So it's not as feasible. And that's worth saying as well. I didn't mention it earlier, but I suppose moving on to the next question, that idea of control, and the other advantage that Britain has is that because South Welsh coal is such high quality and available in such high quantities as well, it's worth saying that the coal field, there is a myriad of different types of coal which are suitable for lots of different things. The infrastructure is already there, both in terms of physical infrastructure, so things like railways, ports, those sorts of things, and they develop through the period, but also knowledge networks, commercial networks. So what happens is the Admiralty is able to utilize agents, essentially, to run the complicated procedures that it needs to. We're talking, just to give a picture, I suppose, of the complexity, the Admiralty is not buying from one colliery, it's buying from several at once. That then has to be, they have to buy that. That then has to be transported to the port. It then has to be transported from the ground or the port to the ship. It then has to be shipped out. It then has to be unloaded at the other end. And all of these different processes involve different groups of people and different businesses. So what the Admiralty does is it doesn't get involved at all in taking control. It utilizes agents essentially to make sure that these processes happen. And this very much mirrors what it does in the 18th century in what's become known as a contractor state, in terms of, you know, buying things like food or beer or, you know, the wood for ships tends to come from Britain's, you know, enormous industrial power at that time. So Britain has that advantage that it can call upon its industry, which is world leading, and its maritime trade, which is world leading. So it really has those advantages. So the Admiralty is able to take advantage of those things to make sure that essentially the coal goes from the mine to the station, which is essentially what it's trying to do.
And you know, an important thing I certainly find in many studies of environmental history and others is the importance of knowledge and of how different historical actors will sort of know and understand the materials or situations that they're working with. And you mentioned there's a series of trials to sort of work out the nature of this coal and what kind of coal it is. Can you tell us a bit more about those trials? And then, you know, when they take place, when it is that the Royal Navy sort of decides like, okay, this is the kind of coal that we need. And if that has any broader effects on this whole system.
Yeah, I mean, it's the I suppose the idea of knowledge is an important one. And it's worth saying that the trials work in two different ways, I suppose. In one way, it's a good way for the Admiralty to, you know, fairly obviously decide which fuel is best for its navy. But on the other hand, it's also a key marketing tool for those that are chosen. And there's what's called the Admiralty List, which is a list of suppliers which the Admiralty would buy from. It doesn't necessarily mean that they do buy from them, but they are of sufficient quality. And if you look in sort of trade directories of the period, that's sort of the number one thing that they will say. If they are Admiralty coal, that is the highest quality that you can get. So it's worth saying it works in both ways. And of course, if you don't have that, then that affects your business because, you know, your competitors are seen to be of higher quality. I mean, the coal trials, as I said, start around the 1840s, really. But they carry on. And I suppose one of the main arguments that runs through the book is that really it's only the 1870s when we start to see the first mastless ships, so the first ships that are not hybrids, so sail and steam, that the Admiralty really starts to pay attention to the real issues it has around the need for coal, and that goes across the need to protect coal, the need to make sure it's there, the need to make sure it's high quality. And that's really where it starts to step up these trials. And really they carry on all through the period, and they're constantly sending messages, for example, to naval officers or governors in various British colonies, but also utilising things like the Royal Geographical Society, the Mining Institute, which is now at Imperial College. When they're sending people out into the wider world, they're trying to get them to come back and say, you know, if there is coal there, can you send some back that we can test? So it carries on all the way through. And it's a really, what the Admiralty is trying to do is both save itself some money, because if it can avoid having to send Welsh coal halfway around the world, then it helps its balance its books. But also there's a worry that, in a potential war, you know, what if we were cut off from Australia, for example? how are we going to make sure that the Navy can still operate? So there is that real need. And again, it's using not just naval networks, but also wider imperial networks to try and find those things. But I think it's interesting in a way, because in a lot of imperial histories of this period, the Navy seems somewhat absent. And I suppose part of what this book's trying to do is say, well, actually, a lot of the knowledge coming back from the empire and the wider world is coming from naval personnel. And, you know, a lot of the networks essentially are run by the Navy, or, you know, our naval ships, for example, carrying messages around. So I think it speaks to a wider sort of imperial picture, really.
Can I ask a point of clarification about the coal itself? Is it simply the case that the South Wales coal was the only coal that was really suitable, or could they burn other coal if they needed to? It just wouldn't be as good.
I mean, there is an issue on the, I suppose, that after it becomes established that it's the best kind of fuel to use, they tend to design the machinery to work best with it. But no, they do use in times of emergency. I mean, there's a huge strike in South Wales in 1898, which is one of the major issues of relying on one source of coal, essentially. And they do use other types of coal, but they try not to. I mean, essentially, I suppose, in a way, the way that they think about this is that if they can't get enough Welsh coal, then they're still going to be using coal that is equivalent or better than their enemies. And because they control so much of the world, essentially, either through empire or through informal economic control, for example, in places like South America, they're able to push out any potential rivals from those markets. So they can use other coal, but as you say, it tends to burn more quickly, and it's not ideal, really, in terms of utilizing. And it's worth going back to these are cutting edge ships. These are millions of pounds, probably now the equivalent of billions of pounds worth of investment. You don't want to then hamstring them by using poor quality fuel that clogs up the engines and makes the cutting edge technology really worth very little. So it's it's like filling a racing car with your ordinary fuel for your runabout. It really
gets to a fascinating kind of wrinkle in the story that you tell in the book of how they sort of know that they're going to rely on coal, and so they begin to construct these knowledge networks. They begin to look more widely for different kinds of coal, conclude that no, coal from South Wales really is the best, and then their engines become more and more dependent on it. So it's like this sort of paradox of an expanding global trade network, of a larger, more powerful navy, and yet they're increasingly reliant on really quite environmentally specific, they really are reliant on the physical environment of South Wales for this whole system.
Yeah, absolutely. And you do get, for example, in the early 20th century, you do get these royal commissions into essentially how much coal is left, because that's the real worry. I mean, it's, as you say, it's a shockingly short amount of time, really about half a century that we're talking about. But even in the turn of the 20th century, people are convinced that coal power is going to last a long time still, that oil power really hasn't developed enough to be challenging it for many decades to come. So there's all these sort of worries and scares about, well, hang on a minute, if this is the case and we continue to use Welsh coal at this rate, are we going to be stuck in 10, 15 years? There are those real worries about, as you say, utilizing that specific area. It's worth saying that this is all balanced out, I suppose, in terms of its rivals, and the fact that its rivals are also reliant on Welsh coal, which becomes a real issue for Germany in the war, because it then has to go back to using inferior German coal, which is quite a difficult thing to do, because you suddenly, your ships don't go as fast or as far as they used to. It's geographically specific, but it's also in Britain. So it always knows it's got control of that trade, unless it's invaded, essentially. And obviously that's got ramifications far beyond what we're talking about. So it's that control, I think, is really important. And I suppose one of the things that I sort of touch on at the end of the book is about that once they shift to oil, then all of these advantages that it's had in terms of the networks of knowledge and purchase and supply, essentially owning all the places where you find the coal, disappears, because it's suddenly Britain has no oil. It's not, North Sea oil is not discovered till much, much later. And essentially it loses all those advantages. This is coupled with Britain's global decline anyway, but it's certainly a factor within that. It's really the geography and I suppose the geology is really important part of it. And Britain's immensely lucky that it has it on its doorstep.
Now, can we follow the coal then from South Wales out into the broader maritime and imperial world? How does it get out there? And what sort of problems do they encounter in shipping coal all over the world?
Yeah, I mean, as I said, it tends to be arranged by coal agents, essentially. So they're utilizing an existing trade and existing trade networks and relationships. It's immensely difficult to find very much on archivally on the specifics of this. Most of the companies are long gone, and the Admiralty, in their infinite wisdom, have thrown away all of the contracts for coal from this period. So in terms of specifics, not very many, but essentially how it works is for many places, there are existing coal networks, essentially, because British maritime trade is global. So you're sending coal from South Wales to places, for example, like the Suez Canal anyway, because that's where British steam trade is going. Further away, you're starting to have to, these agents are starting to have to, essentially make bespoke routes for the Navy. You wouldn't usually, from a commercial perspective, send Welsh coal much further than the Mediterranean, because it's just completely uneconomical. And when they do that, what they try and do is try and put it into another trading network. So, for example, they put it in things like grain networks in South America, or nitrates. So they'll send coal out one way and come back with something of more value. They may still make a loss on that, but they're trying to I suppose make those as minimal as possible by coming back with something that's not of as little value as the coal. But it's instructive on the importance of the quality, the fact that time and time again, when questioned by governments about the expense of doing this, they come back and say, if we want a navy, that is world leading, that is able to do all the things we're asking of it. This is what has to happen. So, it's essentially utilizing commercial networks, but further afield, having to, I suppose, create these bespoke networks that that bring in other trades to try and subsidize essentially the costs.
And much of the coal is shipped out on sail or by sail driven ships. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean it's quite an irony really that especially much further when we're talking much further out. Even in 1914, you're seeing sail ships taking out coal to places like South America, which seems slightly perverse, but as I'm saying, it's not a rush to get it out there. Generally, once you have the knowledge in place of how much needs to go out at certain points, it doesn't really matter how quickly you're sending it out, and it really is. I suppose in one way, in the enormous quantities the Admiralty is buying it, it's quite expensive. But in terms of sending stuff around the world, it really is bulk commodities. It's really not a high value trade. So you don't want to be sending it out in fast steamships because it's just too expensive to do so. You might as well send it out in a sail ship. And there is a level of irony there, I think. But it seems remarkably backward, but that was the most efficient way to do it, and the most economical way to do it.
And the quantities we're talking about are truly enormous. If I recall the numbers, HMS Dreadnought, 1906, it could store 2,900 tons of coal, and it would use about 300 a day. Is that about right?
Yeah, and you're talking huge numbers of ships as well. And as I mentioned earlier, it's difficult to get exact numbers because the documents no longer exist. But you can look at, as you say, these sorts of figures, the size of bunkers and the use, how much they're using, and put it next to how many of these types of ships are there. It's huge numbers, really, really enormous numbers. But you're talking about, today I've been writing something about the Welsh coal industry. So, you're talking about an industry that in 1913 employs 1.1 million people. It's a huge industry. It really is a huge part of the British economy generally. So, it's easy to forget in our modern world, and especially in Britain, which is moving more and more away from coal, how big a part of that economy and how much of Britain relied on coal essentially, and particularly the Royal Navy. I suppose it seems a bizarre topic, but the more you look at that period, the more important you see that coal is essentially. It's, we talk about oil these days as that sort of, the global commodity and all of the wars and things that happen over that. Well, coal is the equivalent in the late 19th century, essentially.
And once the coal is being shipped out into the rest of the world, there has to be storage facilities and essentially coaling stations. Can you tell us about those, the major ones, and what sorts of places these were, and the sorts of environments that are effectively created through the storage of coal there?
Mm. Yeah, I mean, it's again another advantage the British have is that they have all these places that they obtain by various treaties in their wars of empire in the 18th and early 19th century, in places like the Falkland Islands and St. Helena, which actually before the coming of steam, they're not really sure what to do with. And they realize that essentially, as you say, they can make these chains of coaling stations. And there's a mixture of stations. There's commercial stations, for example, places like Port Said or Hong Kong, where they're major trading places where there would be coal anyway, because there are you know, steamships for commerce. And the Admiralty in those cases would have its own stacks that were for solely for the use of the Navy. Other places like, you know, Gibraltar or Simonstown, which is essentially just round from Cape Town, are naval bases. Yeah, essentially that would be a naval supply. So it's a mixture of different types of places. And largely they move away from buying coal on the open market from the 1870s onwards because they realize that this is quite an expensive way to do things. It's a variety of different places, essentially. Many of them are fairly small places, but again, some of them, like Hong Kong, are enormous trading centres. So what you start to see really is an enormous variety of places that the Navy is stopping. And it's worth making the point that we started off talking about how, you know, they'd have to stop for coal every 7 days. This is much more regularly than a sail ship would go into a port. And as well, because the advantages that steam gives a ship, you know, it can travel in straight lines. It's not reliant on tides or wind to get to places. It can go much faster. What happens is that increasingly you can essentially station ships around one particular place and then send them out to do things rather than have them sort of generally patrolling around. Also, of course, Britain's primacy means that it also doesn't really need to because it doesn't have a major rival. So what happens is increasingly you're seeing ships stationed on these harbours. And I did a few calculations and it's between about 70 and 80% of time that a sailor would be on a particular commission, usually about 3 years, it would be on land. They would be on land. So this is including, you know, doing repairs or whatever. But a lot of the time they are in these small spaces that become really multicultural spaces because, of course, they're also places of labour. So another one of the things that I look at is, you know, it's all well and good saying that the coal's there, but how are you actually going to get it onto the ship? So particularly in places, I suppose what might be termed the colonial empire, where not the white settler colonies, but places in Southeast Asia, for example, in Africa and the Caribbean, they would become places where people would move to for work. So increasingly, these become places where you have inadequate housing, for example, disease becomes rife, people are exploited with very low wages. And because of the presence of sailors, you also see an increasing reliance on their money. So this could be, you know, things like washing facilities, it could be food, it could be a place to stay, alcohol, but also things like prostitution. And in this, in many of these places, things like venereal disease become rife. So it really changes those environments because they suddenly become very important centres of labour and of commerce and of exchange. It completely changes those places.
And they really become nodes in a kind of broader fossil fuel energy network, which is, you know, to a considerable degree facilitating the broader globalization of commerce in the late 19th century.
Yeah, absolutely. And a node is a nice way to put it, actually. In a way, it reflects that the British Empire more generally. I mean, when I teach about the British Empire, I often show the famous map with all the bits painted pink. And the general understanding of the empire is that these pink bits are the most important bits. And in fact, what I would argue is really what you're looking at is maritime commerce. And so because you're looking at that, those nodes around the world, the commerce centers, but also the naval centers, are really the crucial parts. And that's what the government are often more interested in, is how do we defend these routes? And as you say, those nodes become crucial because that's where the Navy, essentially have to go to pick up the fuel to be able to defend what is the lifeblood of the empire, which is maritime trade. So, yeah, absolutely. I think it's a really nice way to think of it as those nodes.
Now, once they have shipped coal in sailing ships out to these various nodes, once the fuel is there at a coaling station someplace, is it basically just kind of a static thing that just sits there and waits to be used?
I mean, this is one of the big problems, really, because when we're talking about a global network, we're talking about lots of different climates, and certainly in tropical climates, of which, you know, large parts of the empire would be within the tropics. Coal does not just stay the same if you leave it out in damp and warm conditions. And the real issue is it starts to degrade and it starts to lose its calorific value, so the power within it, essentially. So the real conundrum for the Admiralty is to make sure that there is enough coal in these places that should there be an emergency, for example, that a ship turned up out of the blue, there would be enough for it. But at the same time, you don't want to be sending all this high quality, expensive coal out to Sierra Leone, for example, or Barbados. And it's basically just, being destroyed by the weather. So it's really trying to balance the two needs, really. And it's what's quite interesting is that it's really the 1880s, which is a long time into having a steam navy, that they really start to think about even simple things like putting marks on bunkers to say when they need to order more coal, essentially, or the station. The person in charge of a certain station sending back a return to the Admiralty to tell them how much is being used. And it's really interesting when you read these things, because you sort of think, do they really know anything about what's going on in these places? Because the sorts of information they're asking for seem very basic, even to the extent that there are questions about, well, what sort of coal are you using? Which you think, after all the importance they put by it, they really should know. And so that really is a big shift that you see in the 1880s, that really they start to take much more control and really start to try and build a knowledge of what's going on and build that knowledge in London, not just amongst what we might call the men on the spot, who are hugely important before this because they're essentially running the show. But there is that sort of move, I suppose, towards really trying to make sure they know what's going on, but also that there is a sufficient supply and it's not going to waste as well.
Under the most extreme conditions, what would the life of coal be in a place like Barbados? Are we talking that it would degrade and become, less effective over the course of a couple of years or a couple of months? Or
it's a good question, and again, exact answers might be quite difficult. But I mean, they tend to, in Britain, they talk about not using coal that's over a year old. So the climate in Britain is obviously very different to somewhere like Barbados. But they try, I mean, one of the solutions that they use is by using what they call patent fuel, which is very similar to what they use on the railways, which is essentially to take the waste product of coal, the smaller bits that break off, essentially make them into bricks, which they can then store very easily, and they keep a 6-month supply of that at many of these tropical stations. So I think that may give an indication of how long that coal lasts. Probably we're talking a few months. But that patent fuel is more expensive than coal, and also has issues with eye and skin irritation. So that they're not particularly keen on it. The people dealing with it. So it's not a perfect solution, but it's one of the solutions that they come up with, because it degrades literally within 6 months in these places.
And wow, so the patent fuel, I think, is a great way to see how then this network of fossil fuel energy that powers the Royal Navy is spatial but also temporally situated. That is, it exists in time in some very real senses, that the fuel will degrade. And then finally, it is very much a human network as well, because as you mentioned, it causes these problems with things like skin irritation. And I think that's a good way into the labor that goes into this at every step. And labor is a major portion of this. Can you describe the labor at different points?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I don't, in the book, I don't go into the actual mining of the coal, but of course, that's a hugely labor intensive thing in itself. But I suppose one of the really fascinating things that I found about this is that, as you say, it's nearly all human labor all the way through the period. And one of the reasons for this is that even in places where they install hydraulic cranes to move the coal about, the huge problem is that the ships get bigger and bigger, and the numbers of ships gets ever larger. So what happens is you can have a hydraulic crane, for example, in Portsmouth, but you can only get one ship in. And increasingly, in some harbours, you can't even do that because ships too big to get into the harbour. So what you have to do is send out what are called lighters, so essentially just ships with coal in them, out to the anchorage point and send several out to them. And then you're essentially using a simple winch system between the ship and that lighter to get the coal on board. Because essentially, because there's too many ships to do with a single crane. So it remains in many places, a wholly human endeavor, and where it's done, as I described, by lighter, it's generally done by the sailors themselves, purely because it's easier, but also it's a nice free source of labor. Where labor is plentiful and cheap, which tends to be the colonial empire, where you have indigenous labor forces which are often exploited with low wages and awful working conditions, you see much more of that indigenous labor being used, essentially walking up planks onto the ship, often with the baskets of coal on their heads. In some places, particularly the Caribbean, Zanzibar, women are involved. In Japan, you have women and children involved in these things. And it really is a fairly horrific process, really. There's plenty written by the sailors themselves about how horrendous it is. But these indigenous populations were doing ship after ship after ship, carrying these enormous baskets of coal. So, it really is a laborious process. We're talking maybe 50 kilo bags of coal being moved around. It's of course also filthy. Plenty of dust goes around, and increasingly, because of the need to do it quickly, accidents abound as well. It's certainly not unusual to find deaths occurring during this loading of the coal, because if the 50 kilo bag of coal falls on top of you, it's going to cause serious injuries. So, what's quite interesting is you never really come across the accounts of this happening to Indigenous people, which perhaps reflects more how important they were seen as being, rather than how often it happened, because it must have been a regular occurrence for those people as well. It was just that they were seen as, yeah, essentially tools for the use of the Navy rather than sort of individual people, in the same way that sailors would be.
Right. And so the source base for actually understanding the Indigenous experiences of work here is quite slim, but it's much more robust for the sailors themselves, who, as you say, get sort of roped into this endeavor. And it basically a weekly thing for the crew. Can you tell us about what they thought of it, how they dealt with this particular task?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's widely disliked, I think is the easiest way to put it. And often it's, you know, through reading sailors' diaries particularly, you get an impression that the worst thing about being a sailor is either loading the coal onto the ship or cleaning up afterwards. And it's usually sort of a toss up between the two. And I suppose the ways in which that they try and alleviate, I suppose, the pain of the coaling so often is to try and find these sort of coping mechanisms. And it's quite interesting that the Royal Navy is pretty much the only navy that I've come across that everyone is involved in coaling. And it may be that, you know, for example, the commanding officer is only involved in making sure everything is going on, but it's not a case of only the lower deck are doing it. But you also see things like the Marine Band would be on board playing tunes to try and cheer them up. They were allowed to wear ridiculous costumes while they were coaling. So you see these great photographs of them dressed up in cricket whites or dressed as the Prime Minister or whatever, as a, you know, sort of a fun way to get through the time. Inevitably, often there is an element of cross-dressing as well, which is a familiar thing for sailors to do. Another key thing, and is very much encouraged by the Navy, is this sense of competition and the issue of mobilisation and the ability for a ship to essentially go in, coal, and come back out as quickly as possible. In wartime, yes, it's an obvious advantage. So they're encouraged really to try and do this coaling as quickly as possible. And what happens is that you get rivalries between different ships as to who can have the highest rate of tons per hour, essentially. And this fits into that sort of wider competition that you see in sporting events and things like that. But what it does is it places a real pride in the act of loading this coal, and it really speaks to these ideas of masculinity and pride and discipline, I think, because the way that sailors talk about, for example, breaking records, there's an immense satisfaction, and often it's something that appears, for example, in newspapers and published books. You know, you get telegrams from the admiral, for example, congratulating them on breaking records. You see photographs of them with a blackboard with their record breaking coaling rate in front of them. So it's a really interesting, I suppose, glimpse into that idea of masculinity and also naval discipline and how they see themselves as. Yeah, these efficient masculine workers, really, and sometimes this takes on a racial element, and they talk about how much better than the Indigenous heavers in Africa they are, because they're not lazy or they're not they don't always want to take breaks, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah, they have naval discipline, which, you know, another race would not be able to deal with. So there becomes that sort of racial element to it as well as that sort of masculinity.
And one point I thought you made that was absolutely fascinating is how once the Royal Navy had switched to oil, you started to see a kind of a retrospective view of coal that reinforced this notion of masculinity, as though they could sort of look back on it and say, boy, that was terrific when, you know, we were manly sailors working with manly coal.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting point. And I mean, most of them, the accounts you see, they sort of talk about they wish for the day when coal would no longer be the fuel. But yeah, as you say, you do come across these accounts that sort of they talk about, yeah, as you say, the sort of the masculine element to it. And it's interesting, I suppose, to think about, you know, you've moved away from a period where you have sail ships which have very specific roles aboard. You know, they had the men that dealt with sails, the men that went up rigging, for example, and these very sort of masculine, skilled pursuits. So in a way, this calling allows them to see themselves in the same light, I suppose, because it's a very physical, very muscular job, which you don't really get with oil. So again, it's that sort of continuation from almost the sail navy, I think, in terms of that sort of masculine ideal of what a sailor was, I think.
Yeah, it's a fascinating work. And I think to wrap up, I have two questions to ask. One is, if we were to consider, broadly speaking, the environmental history of the world, of the British Empire in the late 19th century, I think a common perception is that coal is the sort of single most important element of the 19th century global industrial revolution. And one thing I find fascinating about this book is that it shows that, like, yes, that's true in some real senses, and that there's a real environmental specificity to this coal. It must be certain kinds of coal. It must be handled and sort of worked with in certain ways. So there are deeply specific spatial characteristics to it. And yet, at the same time, the it comes with its own wrinkles. That is, only certain kinds of coal will do. The labor is done by hand in many cases. The coal itself is shipped by sail in most cases. So there's a fascinating like sort of yes and no aspect to the centrality of coal, broadly speaking, in the late 19th century. Would you say that that's, do you agree with that assessment, or do you have more to add to that?
Yeah, I think that's yeah, that's a really interesting way to look at it. And I think, I suppose what I find very interesting about it is that from a naval perspective, often it's seen in a very Whiggish way of, you know, it made, you know, ships faster. It meant that you could have iron ships. It meant that you could have, you know, bigger guns aboard, et cetera, et cetera. And it doesn't necessarily think about all of those infrastructural and environmental factors, which cause a lot of problems and labor as well. And I suppose in another sense is that in histories of, I suppose, you know, both mobility, but also mobility of material items, often we think about the really sort of high profile things that move around, things, you know, high value, silk, you know, tobacco, those sorts of things, rather than the very sort of quotidian stuff that essentially made the world go round. You know, not just coal, but things like iron ore or copper ore, or, you know, those sorts of things that were crucial to the British economy, but lack that sort of excitement, I suppose, that that perhaps, you know, the gold or silver or diamonds or jewels and those sorts of things, that sort of cachet that they have. So I think in a way, one of the things that I'd like to, I suppose, inspire in people is that things that can seem very dull and very boring and very sort of quotidian actually are hugely important and can be hugely important and have ramifications far beyond, you know, the economic, this is how much was sent here, this is how much was sent here. Yeah, really, they have enormous effects all over the world. And you know, coal is a good example of how that happens, I think.
As a scholar of wheat, flour, and bread, I could not agree more with that assessment. Now, one final question before I let you go. What kind of future research do you have in mind? What are you working on now?
I'm working on a few things, inevitably. And one of the things that I suppose the next big project that I'll be doing is looking at particularly the sorts of things that sailors are sending back from these stations that they're based at, particularly around the empire. And one of the things which I sort of came across while writing the book was how much of this is about both environment, but also animals. So one of the things I've been interested in recently is thinking about the relationship between sailors and animals and what that tells us about the way that they view the world. So in many different ways, but particularly in terms of things like exoticness, you know, what that might tell us about what they think of various places around the empire. And also the way that many of these things come back to a domestic audience and shape the way that they see the empire as well. So it's really sort of trying to understand the role that these, I suppose, natural aspects of the empire that are brought back in by various means, how they affect the imagination of what the empire is and what British power is in the wider world. So it's still very much in the early stages, but particularly that's, I suppose, where I'm going at the moment.
Well, it sounds like a terrific topic, and we wish you all the best in that research, and we look forward to hearing more about it in the future. Thank you very much, Dr. Gray. It was an absolute pleasure. Once again, the book is Steam Power and Sea Power, Coal, the Royal Navy, and the British Empire, 1870 to 1914.
Thanks very much.
My pleasure.